Not since Twain has America produced a satirist this funny. It's what the writer Zadie Smith says about George Saunders. Saunders is the author of such books as In Persuasion Nation, The Brief and Frightening Reign of Phil, and Pastoralia. In 2006, he received a MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant and a Guggenheim Fellowship. His first nonfiction essay collection is called The Brain Dead Megaphone. Here's George Saunders reading an excerpt from the title essay of The Brain Dead Megaphone.
Imagine a party. The guests from all walks of life are not negligible. They've been around, they've lived, suffered, they own businesses, have real areas of expertise. They're talking about things that interest them, giving and taking subtle correction. Certain submerged concerns are coming to the surface and, surprise, pleasant surprise, being confirmed and seconded and assuaged by other people who've been feeling the same way. Then a guy walks in with a megaphone. He's not the smartest person at the party or the most experienced or the most articulate, but he's got that megaphone. Now say he starts talking about how much he loves early mornings in spring. What happens? Well, people turn to listen. It would be hard not to. It's only polite. And soon, in their small groups, the guests may find themselves talking about early spring mornings. Or more correctly, about the validity of megaphone guy's ideas about early spring mornings. Some are agreeing with him, some disagreeing, but because he's so loud, their conversations will begin to react to what he's saying. As he changes topics, so do they. If he continually uses the phrase, at the end of the day, they start using it too. If he weaves into his arguments the assumption that the west side of the room is preferable to the east, a slow westward drift will begin. These responses are predicated not on his intelligence, his unique experience of the world, his powers of contemplation, or his ability with language, but on the volume and omnipresence of his narrating voice. His main characteristic is his dominance. He crowds the other voices out. His rhetoric becomes the central rhetoric because of its unavoidability. In time, megaphone guy will ruin the party. The guests will stop believing in their value as guests and come to see their main role as reactors to the guy. They'll stop doing what guests are supposed to do, keep the conversation going per their own interests and concerns. They'll become passive, stop believing in the validity of their own impressions. They may not even notice they've started speaking in his diction, that their thoughts are being limbed by his. What's important to him will come to seem important to them. Now, we said megaphone guy isn't the smartest or most articulate or most experienced person at the party, but what if the situation is even worse than this? Let's say he hasn't carefully considered the things he's saying. He's basically just blurting things out. And even with the megaphone, he has to shout a little to be heard, which limits the complexity of what he can say. Because he feels he has to be entertaining, he jumps from topic to topic, favoring the conceptual general, we're eating more cheese cubes and loving it. The anxiety or controversy provoking, wine running out due to shadowy conspiracy, the gossipy, quickie rumored in South Bathroom, and the trivial, which quadrant of the party room do you prefer? We consider speech to be the result of thought. We have a thought, then select a sentence with which to express it, but thought also results from speech. As we grope in words towards meaning, we discover what we think. This yammering guy has, by forcibly putting his restricted language into the heads of the guests, affected the quality and coloration of the thoughts going on in there. He has, in effect, put an intelligence ceiling on the party.
It's a real extraordinary image, isn't it? It's one thing to ignore, if you can, the television over in the corner, because you can turn it off. But this party that we're at is where we all live, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think turning off the TV is an option, and it's one that I tend to use. But sometimes I think it's kind of like if you found yourself in a maze, and this maze had all kinds of shelves and tables, and every one of them was covered with some kind of junk food. You could force yourself to avoid the food, but the longer you stay in there, you know, the odds are you're going to take something and your weight's going to go up. So even though a given person can avoid it, and I suppose should avoid it, cumulatively, I think there's an effect of sort of absorption of this kind of megaphone stuff.
So when did this start happening, do you think? When did you begin to notice it for the first time?
Well, you know, this is a funny thing. An essay like this is strange because I don't have any expertise in this at all. But anecdotally, it seems to me it started sometime around the OJ deal. The feeling is it has something to do with the 24-hour news cycle. And, you know, the sense that if you have 8 hours, to say something that you should or could efficiently say in 15 minutes, this then sort of back affects the tonality of what you're saying. And I think that's when it started, and I think then it became sort of ritualized. And so now you have these, you know, the need to fill vast amounts of airtime with very little information, which is almost a recipe for vapidity.
So you're saying the O.J. trial was really about 15 minutes worth of news that turned into 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Yeah, well, and I'm kind of a Luddite, so for me it was 0 minutes of news. You know, I mean, there's no news in Guy Kills Girl. That's been going on since the Stone Ages. You know, as Thoreau says, you can basically take any newspaper from any time, and there's going to be an earthquake or a scandal or a murder or a fire, and the only difference is the proper nouns. So really, there was no news. And likewise, you know, this is sort of a commonplace, but you look at a thing like Anna Nicole Smith, there's no news. There's nothing to be seen there except the kind of, you know, accident-watching gossip sort of mode.
Right, but people actually got interested in this. I can remember going to restaurants where they had the O.J. trial on.
Sure. The truth is, if you put two mice on television, eventually people would get interested. Did you see what Whitey did? You know, it isn't really, I mean, human beings love narrative and we'll find it anywhere. So I think probably if the old man in me recedes a little bit, it's always been fun to gossip and to think morbid thoughts and so on. So I'm not really even against it. But I think when it begins to erode the entire fabric of the culture, then we might want to reexamine a little bit.
Well, and as you put it in the essay, when the media identifies someone as an expert, we just kind of assume their area of expertise is important.
I think, you know, there's something funny about the way that the format drives content. So we find ourselves talking about things that in our private lives we'd probably never talk about, or if we felt inclined to, we might have the self-discipline to avoid it. But you sort of dress it up and you make it look good and sound good, and suddenly it does have a kind of authority. And again, I don't suppose there's anything wrong with it, but I became aware of this around the time of the Iraq War, when the same tonality that was in format that had been developed for OJ to expand that non-story was being used to talk about this incredibly important thing. And it struck me as a failure of culture, because what culture is supposed to do is at that critical moment when you're deciding whether to invade a place, all the resources of the nation, all the wisdom of the nation should be brought to bear. And within that very, very weird limiting format, driven by people, you know, like O'Reilly and so on, we didn't get all of our resources to the table. You know, the normal resources you would use when you're trying to figure out whether to kill somebody, and we were trying to figure out, as it turns out, whether to kill hundreds of thousands of people, the spiritual, ethical, artistic concerns that are not baby games, serious stuff, that never got brought to the table, in part, I would argue, because of the restrictive entertainment-driven format in which we were having this discussion.
It's one thing when Megaphone Guy is at the party speaking about how he feels about early mornings in spring, but when it starts to be a discussion of whether we ought to go to war and whether, as a result, several thousand people will die, you suddenly get angry that megaphone is drowning out the discussion.
Absolutely, because we've taken, you know, thousands and thousands of years to develop things like art and literature and so on. And probably in our culture, we've come to see those as ornamental or, you know, as indulgences. But the truth is they were first developed in order to bring to bear the entire human consciousness to these decisions in incredibly nuanced, sophisticated ways. And so we discount those at our own peril. And I think now we sort of start to see the fallout of that. And also, you know, it's clear that these format issues we're talking about are primarily economic manifestations. There's nobody saying, oh, it's much more beautiful or kind of charming or intelligent if we do it this way. It's clearly being driven by economics. So it seems to me that's something, you know, that should be examined.
Talking about Iraq, you said that it was a literary failure. You mean it's a failure because all of this is about storytelling and we're not telling good stories anymore?
No, I mean it's a failure of imagination. That one of the things we do historically when deciding whether to invade a country or have an affair or, you know, have a child out of wedlock or whatever, is that we examine these things with all our resources of imagination. And one of the ways we make that decision is to imagine the actual complex reality on the other end of the missile. This is not as easy as it sounds. I mean, if I say, you know, I'm sitting here in Syracuse, let me imagine Madison. Well, I've been there a couple times. I don't remember much. I can remember two or three sort of vague street scenes. That's all I can really summon up of Madison. So if I have a missile aimed at Madison, what literature lets me do, if I've trained myself in it, is get past my initial boneheaded projection into a more detailed three-dimensional projection of what's actually on the other end. And I think that's where it was a literary failure. We have the resources in our country to make those decisions with a complex imagination, but because we trusted what I'm calling megaphone guy, we made that decision on the thinnest, most ridiculous little projection that had to do with words like WMD and, you know, bouquets will be thrown and so on. So that's why I say it's a literary failure. We needed to use our literary capabilities to fully imagine what we were about to do.
So what do we do with megaphone guy? I mean, he's here, frankly, and he's not going to go anywhere. So you've got the guy with a megaphone. You try to, what, tone him down?
Well, one thing I think you try to do is not be him, which we all are. I mean, I'm probably doing it right this minute. But I think, you know, when Barack Obama gave his speech on race, I thought that was a beautiful illustration of the ways that in incremental ways, each of us can sort of participate. That speech was so honest and articulate and bold that it sort of made a beautiful case for being articulate and for being frank and for the ability of language to go into these incredibly nuanced, difficult places. So I think really, in some ways, the end of the essay is a fizzle because basically I say, well, there's this big problem, there's this horrible guy, megaphone guy, revise your work. You know, that, I mean, and it is a little bit of a letdown, but honestly, I think that's really, like so many things, you know, you can sort of propose the USA Today solution. We're getting more articulate. But I think in reality, it's just a, you know, it's a slog. It's each of us recognizing that, you know, precision is important and that revision is important. And also calling a spade, you know, some of the most refreshing things that happened during that crazy post 9/11 period. I remember Tom Daschle and Al Gore on the same weekend both saying, no fair. You can't simply call everyone who disagrees with you, President Bush, unpatriotic. And I remember just getting this rush of adrenaline like, oh, thank God someone spoke the truth. You know, we shouldn't underestimate these small victories because actually they're not all that small.
George Saunders is the author of a collection of essays called The Brain Dead Megaphone.
And one more thing.
Can I take your country? Won't be the baby, can I take?